Good morning and welcome to Focus 580. This is our telephone talk program. My name is David Inge, and we're glad to have you listening this morning. In this first part of Focus 580, we're going to talk about a bit about American history and actually explore a chapter in Illinois history that perhaps many people are not familiar with. And it concerns one of the earliest and perhaps most important struggles between pro- and anti-slavery forces in the new American Republic. It took place in the 1820s, and indeed it took place here in Illinois. And one of the results was rioting, arson, and mob violence across the state. We'll be talking this morning with the author of a book that explores this chapter of Illinois history. His name is James Simeone. He is Associate Professor of Political Science at Illinois Wesleyan University, and the book is titled Democracy and Slavery in Frontier Illinois, and it's published by the Northern Illinois University Press, and looks at this period in Illinois history where there was a strong movement by pro-slavery forces in the southern part of the state to virtually set up an independent state where these people, most of them had been Southerners who had migrated into the state from the South, hoped to create a bottomland republic of farmers who could own slaves on the basis of popular sovereignty, and set up a great battle between them and those people who were interested in maintaining the state of Illinois as a free state. And in many ways, this struggle prefigured the one that would take place later and, of course, would influence national politics and lead up to the Civil War. As we talk this morning with James Simeone, you certainly should feel free to call in. Maybe you'll have some questions to ask yourself. We involve people in the conversation. Anybody who would like to call in, certainly welcome to do that. The only thing we ask is that people just try to be brief in their comments so that we can keep things moving along and involve as many people as possible. But anyone is welcome to call. Here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line. That's good anywhere you can hear us around the state. Even in Indiana, if you'd like to call in, you certainly can. The number is here locally is 333-9455. And then a toll-free, 800-222-9455. And if you match up the numbers with letters on the phone, you get WILL, 333-WILL, and toll-free, 800-222-WILL. Professor Simeone, hello.
Hello, David.
Thanks for talking with us today.
Well, thanks for having me.
We appreciate it. I think first maybe it'd be interesting to talk just a little bit about what Illinois was like at this time, because certainly in many respects it was different. Certainly in terms of where most people lived, it was different because most of the people at the time were living in the southern part of the state and along the edges, along the waterways, which is what you would expect because those were the major roadways of the time. And like today, I suppose the one certain thing you could say is that people wanted to live there because it was very good farmland.
Oh, yeah. I mean, what's really special about Illinois is the fact that it had such good bottomland, farmland near rivers. And, of course, rivers were so important for not only for transportation but also for water. And, of course, now we think of ourselves as the prairie state. And back then, however, you know, it took a steel plow invented by John Deere and six oxen to break the prairie. So back before 1830, when the majority of the people, as you say, lived in the southern tip of the state, you really did need to live near the forest, and the forest and the rivers were really important. The other thing about the forest is it gave you wood for heat. So I guess some people, you know, they don't realize that all that great prairie farming land was not really accessible to the early farmer.
And how many people were there in Illinois, roughly speaking, at the time?
Well, 1820, there were about 50,000.
Mm-hmm. And that would have just been, I think, a little bit more, not much more than it would have been required to be a state.
Well, yeah, that was one of those sources of controversy. In fact, in 1818, the standard number, and I say standard, the number that Congress is using was 40,000. And, of course, Illinois, when they did their first census, only came up with 35,000. So, and that was important for the history of the state because all the people who wanted to become a state were really under the gun. They felt that they needed to appease Congress, and so when they did another census 6 months later, they came up with 40,010. So consequently, though, when they wrote the Constitution, they felt they had to do it in a way that would please Congress, and of course that led to trouble later on.
Mm-hmm. Illinois has always been an interesting place because of the kind of divisions of priorities. It seems always to have been a very interesting mix of people who really had different ideas about what kind of a place they wanted it to be. And I think, interestingly enough, you write at one point in the book this line that Illinois was a northern state settled by Southerners, that right there seems to set up the possibility of conflict. When you look at the people within the state of Illinois, those who wanted it to be a free state and those who wanted it to be a slave state, let's talk about those two groups of people. I mean, those people who were interested in Illinois not permitting slavery, who were they and where did they come from?
Well, yeah, you make a good point. For people listening, they really have to realize that at least 80% of the people who settled Illinois, these 50,000 we're talking about in 1820, at least 80% were from the South. And that group that was anti-slavery, many of them were from the South. Many of them indeed were slave owners themselves. Certainly, Edward Coles, who sort of led the anti-slavery movement, was from Virginia, and he inherited 19 slaves from his parents. And yet, when he came to Illinois, he had the idea that Illinois was, a free state, and he wanted to start a new chapter of his life in a free state. But of course, there were also among those 20% of people who weren't Southern, many who were Northerners, who were very committed to anti-slavery, and they saw the Northwest Ordinance of 1787, which guaranteed that there would be no slavery in the Northwest Territory, as their sort of guiding light.
And on the other side, those people who wanted slavery to be permitted, where did they come from?
They're sort of the most interesting people in this whole drama, I think. They were historians have called sort of the backcountry people. That is, people who came into the United States between about 1720 and 1780. They came mainly from what's called the borderlands of northern Britain. They were Scottish and English and Irish, the Reavers, as they're sometimes known in English history. And they came in through Philadelphia, and they immediately settled the land that was available, which was in the mountains and in the western section of the settled part of the United States at that time. So, what's so interesting about this group of people who came to Illinois and called themselves the white folks was that, they, as the backcountry, as sort of the backbone, the lower classes of the United States at that time, they really, I guess you could call them people with a chip on their shoulder. They felt that they had fought the revolution and won it, in the trenches.
Mm-hmm.
And then when time came to form a government, they weren't recognized. So there were still property qualifications for voting, et cetera.
Mm-hmm.
So when they came to Illinois, they felt, okay, this is where we're going to set up our own state under our own rules.
And I think that's an interesting point that, again, people should kind of bear in mind when they think about what's going on here in the state of Illinois and in the country at this time. This was the frontier. And that there were a lot of people who came here with the idea that this was a new place, there were going to be new rules, they were going to start off anew with a clean slate. Of course, then there was this recipe for conflict because different groups of people have different ideas about what place, kind of place it was going to be. But it seems that an awful lot of people came here with the idea that they were going to start anew. They had a certain sense, a set of ideas and ideals, and thought here was, in a sense, a blank canvas that they could paint on.
Oh, absolutely. And you're right to stress the fact that it's the frontier. It's the absolute western point of American expansion at this point in the history of the nation. And you're absolutely right also to focus on the fact that whatever Illinois was going to become, as far as the backcountry, upland southerners, the 80% who settled it were concerned, it was going to be a state that fostered and benefited the values and interests of the poor white southerners. And, of course, they didn't necessarily want slavery at the beginning, but what happened was they blamed the 1818 Constitution for the Depression. Of course, you remember in your American history, the panic of 1819. Basically, the country was in a deep depression at that time, and they felt that they were getting immigrants from the South who would bring their slaves in, and even though the Constitution of 1818 said that slavery was hereafter prohibited, it sort of suggested that slavery was, that the existing slavery was okay. Mm-hmm. And further, it made special provisions for those people who would bring their slaves in and could indenture them. So the idea was, and in particular for the Salines down in Gallatin County and Jackson County, but the indenture provision was restricted in the 1818 Constitution so that only those slaves that were brought in to work the Salines were now permitted. Previous to that, during the territorial period, anyone could bring their slaves in and indenture them for as much as 30, 40, 50, 60. There's even some records showing indentures of 100 years. So basically de facto slavery. Mm-hmm. And this allowed the southern immigrants to come into Illinois. After 1818, they all went to Missouri. So the idea was, you know, everything was great in Illinois until we passed this darn 1818 Constitution, which we had to write a certain way to please Congress because we were short on our numbers. And now we have an economic depression, and it's all these outsiders and Easterners who are ruining it for us.
Yeah. And it's really, it's interesting to, and I don't know if this is, some people would say this is looking at this period through a contemporary lens, but you seem to be making the case that what's going on here is a real class conflict, that these people that we're talking about who are, say, poor or maybe lower middle class farmers, the people who actually apparently do refer to themselves as white folks, really see themselves as in a pinch between blacks and Indians on the one hand and upper class whites on the other. And it really does take on, it seems to take on this dimension of, one of the dimensions it seems to take on is a dimension of class warfare.
Well, that's right. And that was very important in the back of these people's minds. I mean, they felt that they had been a dejected and rejected class in the eastern United States. And so it wasn't just political equality they wanted, and that's something that they didn't feel like they had in the east. They also wanted social equality. And when the Depression went down, and the economy went down in the Depression, there was this sense that by hook or by crook, we're going to make it so the white folks can farm and make money. And, of course, the bottomlands were so filled with vegetation. They were thought to be sickly. Indeed, many people died of a version of malaria, the ague, in the bottomlands as they were farming. And the idea was, well, if you could clear the bottomlands of all this miasmatic vegetation, and you could use the slaves to do that, you would then be able to farm the fertile bottomlands. And even though you were sort of doing it in a subsistence way, you'd have a little extra for the market. And that's what was nice about the bottomlands. They were so fertile. And consequently, you could make that transition from being a squatter to being a landowner. And once, of course, you were a landowner, now you had you were forced to have others recognize you. And so the irony, though, is that this sort of storyline, which did indeed focus on the class motives of the white folks, shifted once the state government was now democratic and the leaders were no longer appointed by the federal government as they were under the territory. It was clear to everyone that political equality and the control over the government would be in the hands of this majority group who called themselves the white folks. Mm. So they got political equality. And consequently, this class element sort of receded to the background, I say. And it became much more important to debate issues that appealed to the white folks. And politicians, of course, needed to find ways to divide the white folks. So that then became very important as well.
Let me just real quick introduce again our guest for this part of Focus 580. We're speaking with James Simeone. He is Associate Professor of Political Science at Illinois Wesleyan University. And we're talking about a chapter of Illinois history that he writes about in his book, Democracy and Slavery in Frontier Illinois, The Bottomland Republic. And it's published by the Northern Illinois University Press. And questions welcome, 333-WILL, toll-free 800-222-WILL. I just wanted to go back just for a second to this, to the term white folks, and somebody I was talking to about this said, does that term really come out of that time? Did these people actually refer to themselves that way? Was it a common, was that in that terminology in common circulation?
Yeah, I got the term from local sources. It's used several times in the newspaper, but the instance that I take it directly from is where an old Tennessee woman who was one of the upland Southerners who had migrated came into contact with a Northern Yankee family. And she made the comment to the after 1815, more and more Northerners started coming into Illinois. And even though they were a minority, they were a significant minority, and they had many leadership positions. So they were sort of politically prominent, I guess you could say. And her statement that rang in the ears of many was, you know, between the Yankees on the one side and the Indians on the other, the white folks are going to be squashed out, as she said. So, you know, that sort of gives you the image and sort of the picture of how these people felt they were being squeezed. You know, on the one hand, you had these whites who were more sophisticated. Of course, it was always commented that the Yankees had their own unusual ways. They wanted to have written contracts. They didn't make contracts with a shake of the hand. You know, they had clothespins and all these unusual fixins. And so they were sort of a sophisticated big folk group on the one hand. And then on the other hand, you had a racial divide. The white folks felt, well, at least if we're poor, we're not black or native.
We have a caller. Others are certainly welcome to join the conversation. 333-WILL, toll-free, 800-222-WILL. We have a caller here at line number one. Hello.
Yeah, I missed the very first part, so you might have mentioned this, but I'm just wondering what these riots and conflicts influence might have had on Lincoln and his political development. I realize he would have been very young at that time, but I'm sure that, you know, this was still, you know, sort of current in, you know, what was going on with politics by the time he started becoming politically active in Illinois.
Definitely. You know, certainly Lincoln, when he was in Indiana, his father belonged to the Hartzell Primitive Baptist, what they called at the time, regular Baptist congregation, in which Daniel Parker preached. And Lincoln always, for the rest of his life, felt that sort of Calvinist variety of baptism was a very powerful and yet mistaken view of theology. And yet he, in the second inaugural, he seems to slip back into that. So I guess that's the influence of early training. Yes, he sort of rebelled from what I would call the white folks' approach. And sure, Illinois politics divided into these two groups, the sort of the milk and cider and the whole hog groups. And the whole hogs were those who completely supported the people and whatever the majority of the people wanted, right? And Stephen Douglas took that approach and called it popular sovereignty. Lincoln took the milk and cider approach. This is the group that said, well, of course, we're in a democracy, the majority is important, but that's not the only thing that you have in a democracy. You also have fundamental principles and basic individual rights. So, yeah, you're absolutely right. I think that is something that we need to keep in mind, that Lincoln was formed by this early struggle, or at least by the culture that this early struggle left.
And of course, technically we live in a republic, not a democracy. That's something a lot of people forget. might argue about just how democratic and small d democratic we really are in this country, given the power of corporations. But
well, fair enough. I mean, but the thing about democracy, as this story I think shows, is there is this majoritarian strain in it, which is part and parcel of democracy. And so when you have people running around saying, well, whatever the majority of the people want, the government has to give them it. Look what's happening in Eastern Europe right now. I mean, you have the exact same problem. People who were excluded in Eastern Europe under the communist system now are taking control. And what's the first thing they do? They lash out at the outsiders, you know, those who are different. In case of Hungary, say the Jews. And yet, I don't think there's more than 5% of the people in Hungary are Jews. Same thing happened in Illinois. As soon as you get into power, the majority says, well, our identity, the people who we are, should reign. And those who are different, the Yankees, the black folks, they're going to be marginalized. And I think that that is part and parcel of democracy. Not that it has to always be what democracy ends up with. But I guess I agree with you that we don't have a pure democracy, but I also say that maybe in the end that's not such a bad thing.
All right, well, thank you very much.
All right, thanks. Just to be clear, say when Illinois became a state, 1818, did the majority of Illinoisans, would they have favored slavery?
No, that's a real tough call. I say without the Depression, no. As I pointed out, a lot of those upland Southerners, the white folks, they came to Illinois precisely because they wanted to get away from slavery. Not only did slavery exclude them because they weren't wealthy enough to own slaves, but it was part of that whole Southern pecking order with the big folks on top down in the plantations and the sort of the white folks as their servants and the black folks as their slaves. And so in many ways they wanted to get away from that tradition, but they... You know, I guess you would say many of them felt that they first had to defeat the big folks. Mm-hmm. And the only way to do that was to say the majority rules and the majority can do whatever it wants. Of course, once you do that, you open the door to slavery.
Well, that's interesting in that respect that people would want to, who would feel oppressed by that system, would have come to Illinois initially with the idea that they wanted to get away from it, and then decided that for economic reasons, their way they were going to get their leg up the economic ladder was in fact to embrace slavery.
Yeah, David, and I would just put to you that process repeats itself over and over again. So I don't think it's unique to Illinois. But yes, that's the paradox of this story.
Let's talk with another caller in Urbana here, line number two. Hello.
Hi. Mm-hmm. My question, I guess, is sort of implied in the whole issue of class difference. But I was wondering to what extent for those, you know, this pro-slavery, anti-slavery argument, there was some consideration for the work ethic, meaning you talked about the poor whites, you know, the white people who had to work for everything they wanted. And so wouldn't that have factored into the idea that the upper class sort of had it easier and therefore they shouldn't have slaves? You know what I mean? Like the American work ethic, as opposed to saying they were opposed to slavery out of consideration for the humanity of the blacks. I mean, does that factor into this at all?
Well, I think both of those approaches to slavery existed. Are you saying that it would violate their own producer norms, you know, to own slaves because they were claiming all along that they were better than the big folks because they were the ones who were doing the work?
Right, right.
And all of a sudden now they're going to, yes, and in fact now they're going to become the slave owners. They're not going to do the work. They're going to lose their sort of special status as the pure good people who
right.
are doing the work while everyone else is living off of them. Yeah,
right.
I think that was a problem, and in fact that was the argument that was used by the anti-slavery forces
right.
that really worked like a charm.
Right, right, right.
And you know, the vote was close. I mean, it ended up being that obviously we know Illinois is a free state. The anti-slavery forces won. It was a 1,600 vote margin in 1824 when they called the convention to change the Constitution. So, I mean, it's not like the anti-slavery forces were in the minority when it came down to a vote. But given the prominence of the conventionists, that is the pro-slavery group, in Illinois politics after the convention, it's pretty clear that at least the cultural persuasion, the producer culture that these white folks had, certainly was predominant in the state.
Right. But the attitudes towards blacks, though, was still pretty prejudiced, right? I mean, it wasn't like they were opposed to slavery because they saw blacks as equal. I mean, it was still the racism was still in.
Totally. I mean, it was a total disaster.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, basically, even though you had the Northwest Ordinance, even though you had the Constitution of 1818, slavery really wasn't eliminated from the state, declared unconstitutional by the Supreme Court until 1845.
Okay.
And then, even then, black men weren't able to vote until 1885.
Mm, okay.
So, yeah, you're absolutely right. That was a long and problematic history.
Right. Okay, thank you.
All right, thank you. We'll go to Bloomington, Illinois for another call here, line number 4. Hello.
Good morning.
Yes.
It seems to me that the discussion that you're having here now is tied in with the capitalistic system. And it seems to me that that the capitalistic system itself is based upon slave labor or near slave labor, even today. What would your comment be on that?
Well, I would just say you have to make a distinction between people who can contract for their labor and people who can't. So I have to see it as an improvement. But it, certainly the idea that that the market and the coming of the market to these backcountry frontier people was a very traumatic experience in their lives. And to go from a subsistence economy to a capitalist market economy was a very difficult transition. And we to this day have difficulty making this transition. So if that's what you're suggesting, I agree. But I would also say that you can't put the blame solely on the market and the fact that people like to trade. I mean, I think you have to look at the fact that people do get caught up in these group identities, which to some extent the market successfully breaks apart. So I don't think that the capitalism is the boogeyman completely, because it actually helps encourage people to think selfishly, yes, and to think of their self-interest and to think individualistically. And it was that kind of thinking which convinced many of the white folks, hey, wait a minute, I'll never even be able to buy a slave anyway. So maybe I ought to not vote for this. So I think it's a mixed bag.
Well, I was thinking of the situation today with the multinational corporations moving into places where the labor costs are as low as possible, and that's what I meant by near slave.
It's happening all over the world.
Yes.
Thailand, Eastern Europe, exactly. I guess our only hope is that people move through these stages of democracy from this sort of majoritarian approach where you actually, force the companies to bend to your will. I guess they're the new big folks to fit into the early Illinois story.
Okay, thank you, sir.
Other questions and comments are certainly welcome. We're a little bit past the midpoint here. We're talking with James Simeone. He is Associate Professor of Political Science at Illinois Wesleyan University and writes about this period of Illinois history in his book, Democracy and Slavery in Frontier Illinois. It's published by Northern Illinois University Press. Questions are welcome. 333-WILL, toll-free 800-222-WILL. Maybe we should talk for a moment about how it is that Illinois entered the Union as a free state, given the fact that we know that there were people who supported slavery. And then when we look at what happened in 1824, when there was this vote for a proposal for a constitutional convention, essentially what that was a vote on slavery. There was the anti-slavery people prevailed, but it was relatively narrow. I think you said it was 1,600 votes different. So we'd know at that time in 1824 that there were still significant numbers of people who would like to have seen Illinois a slave state.
Right.
How is it that Illinois came into the Union as a free state?
Well, don't forget the French. Don't forget that the French, that Illinois was part of the Louisiana Territory after 1717. And again, the fertile bottomlands were so attractive. And with slave labor, they were able to export food to New Orleans. So the French colony grew rapidly, and so did the slaves with them. I think they had as many as 600 in 1750. But then when Illinois was, after the Revolutionary War, Illinois basically became part of Virginia in 1778. And that's really where the sort of bone of contention began, because in 1783, when Virginia ceded the land of Illinois and most of the Northwest Territory to the U.S., they included a provision that said that the French and other inhabitants of Illinois would be secure in their rights and possessions. And that was interpreted to mean that existing slavery was okay. And so when the Northwest Ordinance came 4 years later, supposedly the interpretation was that it only prohibited future slavery, bringing new slaves into the state. So that was the sort of, there was a conflicted reading of the law. And the locals, of course, especially the local slave owners, took it to their advantage. And there was sort of a compromise in the state at that point. The anti-slavery forces said, okay, knowing that they were, if not in a minority, in a very slim majority, they were willing to compromise and say, okay, well, existing slavery will sort of ignore, but we know that in the future, Illinois will become a free state. And, of course, that all was unsettled when Edward Coles came and became governor, and immediately in 1822, in his inaugural address, said, let's get rid of every element of slavery in this supposedly free state.
I want to make sure that we talk a little bit, because here I'm sure this is a part of Illinois history, again, that I think a lot of people wouldn't be familiar with, about just how much conflict there was around this issue at this time, to the point where the state house actually was burned down. And I think there were people who probably would have liked to take the governor, Mr. Coles, out and string him up.
They certainly burned him in effigy.
And they did that, and he's probably lucky that that his house didn't get burned down.
Well, they burned his part of his farmhouse, and they burned all his peach trees and apple trees.
Oh, yeah, that's right. Let's talk about about all of this conflict, real actual physical conflict.
Well, you know, as happens in these situations where political authority is really being contested, and there's a question about who actually controls what's going on, there was a lot of disruptive behavior. There were 13 murders in a two year period between 1822 and early 1825. I guess it's 2.5 year period. And many of those murders were tied to disputes that individuals and families had, between members of families over slavery and anti-slavery. So, this was one of those situations where you not only had the political authority being contested, but also the whole social order was in a way being contested. And the white folks were saying, whatever happens, we're going to stand in the middle of this and be the power force. Mm-hmm. And, of course, there were many people with refined educations who thought that was ridiculous. You know, that basically in the past in America, people who were poor and uneducated deferred to those who were wealthier and had better education to be the leaders. And suddenly the white folks were saying, no more. Now the common man is actually going to rule. And, you know, when that happens, you have a kind of a social shift, and that's what I think explains the unsettling of the community, and that's what explains all the arson and robbery and violence.
Hmm. This was, in effect, a kind of a popular uprising.
Yeah, I mean, when those people who came to Governor Cole's house in Vandalia and said, you know, and burned his effigy and groaned outside his house, they felt that you know, here he was, this Virginia plantation owner who really didn't understand what it was like to be a poor person in Illinois. You know, he had just come in 1819. He was a relative newcomer. And they were worried that they, in the case of Vandalia, that they were going to lose the state capital designation. So their lives, their livelihoods were on the line. Hmm. And they felt that he didn't understand that, and so they wanted to impress upon him that point. And that's what happened. You know, that's why people get out in groups of people and go outside somebody's house and sing songs and riot.
Hmm. Who was it that was leading the constitutionalist forces? That is, those people who were pushing for the Constitutional Convention, who essentially were really arguing for legalizing slavery in Illinois. Who was leading that side of this?
Well, you have William Kinney from St. Clair County. You have who's a very popular man. You have people like Elias Kent Kane. Kane was a New York attorney. He's a very scholarly man who ironically, many of the leaders of the pro-convention, pro-slavery movement were Northerners who were, in fact, well-educated and indeed had a lot of land. This typically happens. You get a new political movement, and the leaders who emerge are what in political science we call policy entrepreneurs, people who see an issue and want to take advantage of it. And in this case, it was people like Kane and also T.W. Smith was also from New York. So it was people like Smith, Kane, Kinney on the eastern side of the state, people like Leonard White and Willis Hargrove. These are representatives from the General Assembly and from the Senate at a time when many of your listeners are not familiar with these people, obviously, but
yeah.
they were a formidable group.
There is then, so obviously we're going very quickly through what is an interesting and sort of complex period, but there is, once we get to 1824, there is this vote that takes place.
Yeah.
And the issue at this point was, should we or should we not have a constitution to talk about, a convention to talk about amending the Illinois Constitution?
Right.
And was it really clear that what they were talking about at the time was that they wanted to change the Constitution so to make slavery legal?
Yes. And, I mean, there is some play there. Conrad Will, who's another one of the leaders, proposed a, in quotes, limited slavery plan. His idea was that in fact the West was different from the North and the South, that it would be a new land where new things were possible. And the idea was that, you know, he didn't want to have Southern plantation slavery. But he did feel that Illinois needed a boost in its economy, and they needed the bottomlands cleared. So his idea was bring the slaves in from the South, who at this point have no hope of ever being free. They'll come to Illinois. They will work, clear the bottomlands, and in 10 and 15 years, they can be sent to Liberia, to Africa, to their freedom. So the idea was, see, this is kind of a middle range. We're pro-slavery, but we understand that this is a risky policy. And in fact, we're also a terrible racist, and we don't want blacks among us, and so we will ship them to Africa.
The vote, the voters rejected, the Illinois voters rejected this proposal for the Constitutional Convention 1824. But what you, I think you said earlier that, in fact, these two sides, these two movements continue to be active and to shape Illinois politics for a long time after that. In what way does this conflict continue to carry on past 1824?
Well, there's so many lessons to come out of it, but I think the the immediate impact was that many of the milk and cider contingent among the common people, among the white folks, realized that it was wrong to say that democracy meant that whatever the majority wanted, they could get, and that there were certain fundamental rights that individuals had that had to be respected. And in particular, the Methodists were very well organized, and in some ways you could say it wasn't the leaders on either side that made the difference. It was the followers, and in particular the followers among the milk and cider Methodists. They were the ones who organized on the ground and in their congregations talked up the anti-convention position. So I think that what happened was, you know, somebody called earlier and asked about Lincoln. I mean, basically the milk and cider people either became moderate Democrats or they became Whigs. And this idea, talk about the influence on Lincoln, the idea that there could be a sort of moderate principled defense of democracy was born in this struggle. And the sort of moderate Democrats and the Whigs sort of realized that they didn't have to argue this political deference position that always seemed to marginalize the people. They could champion the people, but with some restraint. And out of that came the Whig Party platform, which, if you remember, Lincoln was sort of on the left wing of the Whig Party. So he, in some ways, was a classic milk and cider person. So that's one of the ways that this had an impact on the political culture of the nation.
Mm-hmm. And so here, there we're really talking about the nation. I guess I was thinking, in a way, I was just thinking about Illinois, but this does extend indeed to have a national political significance.
Well, when you look at the Lincoln-Douglas debates, it's basically a rehash of the arguments that were made in 1824. And Douglas is arguing for popular sovereignty, by which he really means that the local majorities should be able to control and dictate policy. And Lincoln called that squatter democracy and squatter sovereignty, and he felt that that was sort of committing this exact error of assuming that the local majority was sovereign, and in fact that even majorities are limited by certain fundamental principles and rights of individuals. So, I mean, I think that the cast and the spin that these essentially local politicians, Douglas and Lincoln, put on their national parties then had the impact nationally.
We have another caller here. It's in Piatone, line number 4. Hello.
Yes, hello. Kaskaskia, the first capital. Pierre Menard,
yes,
Frenchman. How long was the capital there at Kaskaskia?
Only till 1820.
2 years. Well, what did it flood out or?
Well, it flooded out in 1844, but no, it was that they wanted. It's a complicated series of maneuvers, but basically Vandalia was in the middle of the state, of that part of the settled state at the time, and the eastern part of the state along the Wabash River and the Ohio felt that Kaskaskia was just too far.
You mean Kaskaskia? Yeah, well, it wasn't. It was just in the bottom land there. The first governor, his name escapes me. But what happened to that first? They were appointed.
Oh, Shadrach Bond.
Chadwick Bond. Yeah, were they appointed then?
The territorial governor was Ninian Edwards, and he was in power from 1809 to 1818. And then, yes, Shadrach Bond was the first governor from 1818 to 1822, and then Edward Coles was elected.
Okay, well, what about Pierre Menard? Was he the...
He was the lieutenant governor.
Okay, now he was a trader, a trapper from... he had been up in the Montana Territory, but he was of means because the house is... where's Chadwick Bond? Now, Pierre Menard House is a public site or a, you know...
Well, Shadrach Bond lived in Cahokia, which was another French town, and I guess, you know, to put the spin I would like to put on what you're saying is that the French actually played a very important role. The upland Southerners who came and settled were very impressed with the French way of life. And the reason Pierre Menard was elected lieutenant governor is because he was so well regarded by everyone. Mm-hmm. And but of course that only strengthened the pro-slavery side because of course the French owned slaves. Okay. Now the French and their approach to slavery was much more mild than in the South or in the Caribbean. In some ways, you could say that they were members of the family and did better in terms of nutrition than the peasants of Europe, which the French were still, in a way, sort of rogues who had broken off from the French Empire.
Right. Well, how come the bell there at Kaskaskia is given by the King Louis of whatever, the 16th or something, to his, well, it says to his, you know, people across the sea? That's a, you know.
Yeah, of course, they had a great tradition of not paying any attention to the king.
Yes.
They were very wealthy in up until about 1760. The French did very well. But my point is that the Americans saw how the French lived in the bottomland and how they farmed it with African-American labor. And they said, that's the model we want to follow.
The white folk term is one that I hear from people from the South, white folk. They still use it. Well, not this, you know, you got to be 65 or more to hear that term.
And this is the thing, is that of course, that name, as Thomas Ford explains in his History of Illinois, it's a mixed bag. On the one hand, it distinguishes you as a white person from a black person on a basis of race. But on the other hand, of course, it originally appeared supposedly from the slave, the house slaves of the wealthy whites who didn't want to refer to their masters in a racial way, but felt free to talk about the rest of the white population, the poor white folks, in that way. And so many of the white folks were conflicted about their own name.
Okay. Very interesting. Wonderful program.
All right. Well, thanks very much for the call. Just real quick, something I did want to ask you about was the role that an Illinois senator played in the Missouri Compromise. I don't know if this is too much of a side issue, but I guess I'm curious about how Jesse Thomas was involved in this whole question here in the state of Illinois and where he lined up and how it is that he became so important in proposing this idea that, yeah, Missouri could be a slave state, but that north of a particular line, we were going to say that there was no slavery.
Well, in a sense, you could see it as yet another example of this Western approach, which is different than the Northern and the Southern, and particularly on slavery. You know, Thomas was a great compromiser. He was a great politician of the quid pro quo, and he was trying to make it into the higher ranks of the Democratic Party, and he saw this as an opportunity to make a name for himself, and indeed, he was the one who proposed the idea of a line.
Mm.
So you could say that's early Illinois' unique contribution, another one of early Illinois' unique contributions to the Republic.
You know, and Henry Clay, I guess, gets a lot of the credit, but we'll have to give some credit to Jesse Thomas then.
That's right.
Well, we're going to have to stop. I want to say thanks very much for talking with us. It's a very interesting subject area.
Well, thanks for having me, David.
Our guest, James Simeone, he is Associate Professor of Political Science at Illinois Wesleyan University, and his book, if you'd like to read it, is titled Democracy and Slavery in Frontier Illinois, The Bottomland Republic, and it's published by Northern Illinois University Press.